The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, I'm Tuan Lee. I'm a Vietnamese Korean American CPG founder based here in Los Angeles. My company is a sparkling farm to can craft cocktail company called Vervet.
Welcome to the Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thanks, Tuan. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
Oh boy, you know, I think for myself, that's an ever-evolving notion, you know. To be a Vietnamese American when I was a teenager in my 20s and 30s and now my 40s has changed in each particular decade, mostly because, you know, as I learn more about Vietnamese culture and history without the filters of external groups, you know, people who are not Vietnamese or Vietnamese American, you know, you gain more information. And I think that collective intelligence continues to evolve my definition of what it means to be a Vietnamese American now. You know, I see it kind of like a living document. I am a living document. It really changes. You know, for me, as a Vietnamese American, what I'm trying to do in my everyday life and practicing the values of my identity is that I really try to portray it as genuinely as possible, you know, and have it to be aspirational. And that's what I'm doing right now.
What does it mean to be Korean American to you? What about that second half or the first half?
Well, I could tell you what it feels like to be Korean American right now, and which is, I think, something that is new in the last decade, particularly the last 5 years. It feels really great to be Korean American. Korean culture has overtaken not just America, but the globe. People from outside of the Korean culture are so interested in the Korean language and food, entertainment and music and styles. So much so that many are moving there and wanting to learn the language and study it. Telling people that I'm Korean American just has people have so many questions. You know, they want to learn so much. I kind of feel like what it is. It's like, wow, this is what it's like to be like British American or French American, Italian American. I didn't expect this to growing up. I didn't expect this to happen. So that's what it feels like to be Korean American. What it means, I think, is, you know, I like being Vietnamese American. It's the don't knowing the difference between Korean, being Korean, and being Korean American. You know, there's a lot of overlap, but there's also, as a Venn diagram in two circles, there's some areas that don't overlap, you know. So, and again, that's also a moving target, you know, that continues to grow and change and shift.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's very apparent in Vietnam, you know, when you go to Saigon and there's a thriving Vietnamese Korean sort of community. I mean, it's outright Korean. There's a Korean district, and there's a lot of Korean people who are doing business in Vietnam. And a lot of the kids now, you know, out at the malls look like Korean pop stars. You know, it's a very interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, you're talking about in Vietnam?
Yes, in Vietnam.
Yeah, the history between the two countries are, you know, is pretty amazing. It's, you know, they've been tied together for a while. I don't know how well known that is, but Korean soldiers were definitely involved in South Vietnam's efforts. And, you know, at that time, you know, Korea was pretty poor. And being able to work with the American government and providing soldiers provided a lot of revenue for the country of Vietnam. You know, much of that money was spent on building a lot of the infrastructure. But at that same time, and that was kind of began the combining these two peoples and communities. There's just like you mentioned, there's a Korean community there too. And when I was in Seoul last year, there's a Vietnamese community in Seoul as well.
Wow.
There's many similarities between the two countries in the last century.
How did your mom and dad meet?
Well, so because of that business interest, my dad was a civilian in Vietnam. And again, he was there looking for economic opportunities. There was a pretty sizable group of Korean American businessmen who traveled to Vietnam during the war effort, you know, to start various businesses. You know, my dad was providing all sorts of commodities to the military effort, t-shirts, bread, you know, whatever he could do. You know, he could provide supplies and food and other items. And so he was there in Saigon doing business. And my mom had left her hometown of Dalat, you know, as a young woman and as a young adult in Vietnam, like many do, they go to the big city for opportunities. And my mom was working in Vietnam. She was a bank teller. And that's how my father and her met. And you know, fell in love, got married, and started a family.
So your father, how did he get into Vietnam? I mean, as a Korean national, right, from South Korea, did he have background in Vietnamese? Did he study the culture? Did he speak English? Like, how does a Korean person in the 70s arrive in Vietnam during the war?
So that was, much of it was set up through the two governments, and with the American government too as well. Because of that effort, they had allied goals. And so you just filed the paperwork. There was a Korean embassy in Saigon. So it was done with the arrangement of all the cooperating governments. And then, you know, just he traveled by boat to Vietnam, and he did not speak Vietnamese, and he did not know anything about the culture. So it was, he just kind of crashed in.
Is he still living today?
Unfortunately, no. We lost my father May of 2020 recently.
Oh, okay. So did he ever actually get to go back to Vietnam?
No, he never did. Sadly enough. And I know that's something that he wanted to do. But you know, he wasn't able to do that.
That would have been a fascinating conversation to see what the difference was in the 70s versus today, and how Korean culture has influenced the you know, the big cities in Vietnam.
Absolutely, absolutely. He would have loved the trip.
Yeah. That's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that you lost him in 2020.
Thank you.
So as I'm reading about the things that you've done in your life, what I'm constantly reminded about when I'm doing these interviews is this idea of range. People who start these businesses rarely, I mean really rarely, come into these sort of things just doing whatever they're doing. Like, it's rare that you meet somebody who started a beverage company who came up in the beverage industry. It's always like things that people sort of like live through tangentially, and they sort of like, you know, fall into their calling as a result of doing many things. And I think that you kind of fall into that that category, right?
I guess I'm 1.5 gen. So, you know, I wasn't coming here. I'm an outsider from on all respects, you know, including a career and job opportunities and entrepreneurial opportunities. So I'm very grateful for all the barriers I've been able to go through, get around, or, you know, manage to mitigate them, you know, to some degree. Entering this space here is food and beverage is something I'm very, very passionate about, you know, and been so for quite a long time. And you're right, there is Asian American founders when it comes to premium booze. I don't know. I think we're definitely less than 3%. And the irony is, like, we know each other. Most of us know each other because there's so few of us. So imagine someone who's a, you know, 1.5 gen being able to do this, you know, have this opportunity. It's a privilege that, you know, many immigrants don't have. You know, maybe their children or their children's children will eventually do. So, and because of that, I feel like that's why the brand and the company is just so intentional. Be able to have this opportunity means for me that I could truly construct a brand and a company on my personal values that have shaped my life, being a Vietnamese Korean American, and be an aspirational model, not just for our own communities, but for others as well.
What kind of adverse experiences are you talking about?
Well, I mean, for one, I first decade of life. Well, that's when I learned I wasn't white, right? As a kid, you learned that pretty quick.
Where did you learn that you weren't white?
Well, so after we you know, left Vietnam, you know, obviously the country fell, and we went to Busan, where my dad is from, and my parents split up there, and so my mom ended up coming to the United States as a refugee. And we ended up in St. Louis, Missouri, which is where I grew up and went to grade school. But yeah, that's where I learned I was the only Asian American. And of course, I was the only Vietnamese Korean American, you know, as well. So it was, yeah, I learned real quick, first day of kindergarten. So it was a very painful realization process. So that's when it was. I mean, I have this belt buckle I still keep with me. Like, I almost became Tony, you know, as a part of, like, this is from my stepdad's family, like this campaign, you know, like.
What prevented you from becoming Tony?
You know, it wasn't me, because I'll tell you what, like, at that time I was like, yeah, please, like, you know, make me white. Like, let's start with my name, you know? So it wasn't me. I don't get the credit. It was my mom. I love my mom so much. We're very close. And somehow she managed to do that, you know, against all odds. There was a lot of pressure on her. You know, it was just, my mom came here by herself. She didn't have the support of her parents and her family, all of her siblings, her brothers and sisters. And she married into this white family. And to this day, like, I'm just so grateful that she managed to hold her ground and, you know, didn't let the legal process, my legal name change, go through. Or oftentimes you don't even go through the legal name change, but you just use it, like, on all of your, for example, your school papers, when you're entering a new grade, you just simply say Tony, you know, and that didn't happen. So, you know, she's the reason.
You know, when we say Tuan, your name, it's typically, the big percentage is Tuan. Right. And I've heard Tuan and, you know, different ways to pronounce, but you pronounced it Tuan when you got on in the introduction.
Tuan. And, you know, I think that's the closest to the Vietnamese pronunciation. It's much closer than Tuan, you know, so I think a lot of people in the States are more accustomed with, you know, Spanish style of pronunciation because of the word Juan. I mean, when I was in grade school, when I started, you know, writing my name, I had a teacher change. They thought that I couldn't write the letter J, so they corrected the T to a J. So it was, but you know, that just shows the impact of, you know, Latin culture, you know, particularly Mexican American culture, you know, already in the Midwest. But yeah, so I've held on to Tuin as sort of, I guess, the best way to pronounce it if you're not a speaker.
Now, growing up in the Midwest, you had arguably three cultures to sort of figure out, right? Your mother's culture, your father's culture, and this new American culture. So I, along with my friends, talk about the third culture. Like, we're third culture kids, but you're not a third culture kid. You're a fourth culture kid. How did you navigate around all that?
I didn't. Poorly. you know, growing up there in St. Louis, Missouri, it was a suburb, actually. It was actually a suburb, you know, Florissant, you know. Florissant was a result of white flight from the inner city. So it was overwhelmingly white. And I think for me, it was like, I think many of us, you know, in the diaspora who grew up in communities like this throughout the Midwest and smaller towns, you know, my mom did her best to, you know, practice the Vietnamese culture, but only within the home, right? And behind closed doors, nothing that was ever visible. You know, and of course, mostly that cultural practice was food, which I loved. But, you know, I was very aware not to be, quote, Vietnamese outside of the home. And then it got so bad, I think, at one time, sort of like the internalized racism, you know, that, you know, I was embarrassed to be Vietnamese. So how I navigated all those cultures was completely avoiding admitting to myself that I was Vietnamese, and let alone Korean. I mean, my father wasn't around at that time, so that wasn't really an issue. Mm. So that's how I navigated it, is simply leaning into assimilation as much as possible as, you know, an 8-year-old, a 9-year-old, a 10-year-old, you know, growing up. And really adopting the culture as much as you can, just short of changing how you look, but wishing that you could.
Yeah, I hope that in a few more months or years that I don't have to talk about this anymore. I can just talk about, right? And it's like, I think in an interview with Ocean Vuong, he talked about this idea of like radical okayness, right? Like we should not have to put the pressure on being normalized, or, you know, we shouldn't have this problem of like just feeling okay with, you know, who we are. We should just have beauty regardless of who or where we come up from.
Oh my gosh, you're absolutely right. You and Ocean, that conversation. Yes, absolutely. The weight should not be on our shoulders.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and you know, you think about many of the social justice movements that have inspired ours, you know, even if it's the feminist movement, the weight shouldn't have been on women, you know, for their gendered identity to be accepted, right?
Yeah.
So like that, it shouldn't be on our shoulders either. It's for culture at large to be not just okay with who we are, but to celebrate it in the way that we do. Very much the same way that I practiced that for my white friends growing up. You know, they never had to defend the fact that they had German heritage or Irish or British or French or Italian or Spanish. You know, it was always, you know, they always came at me as like aspirational. You know, I remember going into the homes of many of my friends and meeting the parents, and they would so proud. They would be so proud, and rightfully so. You know, this is our family heritage. This is where we come from. And there was, you know, at that time, there was really, you know, they were experiencing a culture where they were embraced. You know, there is a large diversity of whiteness, you know, so to speak, you know, happening at that time. And I think we're beginning to see that happen for the Asian ecosystem. I think people are beginning to realize how many different countries there are and knowing the difference between those. And in seeing where Korean and Japanese culture is, where they're headed and what they've been able to accomplish, you know, I fully expect that to continue, and with the other Asian cultures too as well. So yeah, I agree. Your timeline is great. In a few months, let's
move on. But I'll tell you, these kids, especially young men who are probably, you know, 18, 20 year old Korean kids who are growing up in SoCal today, those guys, they have the life, right? I mean, if you think about it, you know, their Korean culture is, I mean, how much consumption is happening on Netflix for Korean content? And just having, you know, I went to a BTS concert, you know, when they were in town here. I went to the last night's show, and just sitting in the bleachers for me, sitting in the audience, and then walking out after the show, I felt maybe 3 inches taller. And, you know, that I can't imagine what it does for a young 15-year-old boy, you know, or, you know, they probably don't even have to think about it. That's the radical okayness of it all. They don't have to even register some, you know, guys our age in our 40s having to, you know, really put up with this bullshit that we had to go through. But then now I'm going to ask this question, and I ask this all the time with my close friends. Do you think that it was better? I mean, now you look back and you see that there's two ways of kind of experiencing America. Was it better that we got to taste that and we have that imprinted on our mind and we can create something beautiful like these products from it? Or would you rather not have gone through it? That's an unfair question, but I mean.
Yeah, well, it is, but this is what I, okay, let me, how do I break this down? Okay, I gained empathy from going through that very traumatic process, right? Of, you know, rooted in racism. And that being able to acquire empathy is truly a gift. And that empathy, how that translated into everything that I do, including my company. That's why it's not just a Vietnamese brand. That's why it's not just a Korean brand. It's very inclusive. We celebrate many cultures on it. You know, we try to, because I know what it's like, you know. I would like to think if I didn't go through that I would still have a natural instinct and curiosity and drive to learn other people's history who have suffered and gained and still gained that empathy. That is the path I would have preferred. So these young Asian Americans, and in this particular example, you know, Korean Americans and Korean American young guys and boys, and like, yeah, they're very lucky. And I hopefully they're practicing gratitude and understand that. And still are able to have empathy. I think those are the true leaders of the world. You know, if you're able to do that, you grew up having that type of identity privilege, and you're still able to gain empathy and understand and see others, you know, and understand what they're going through.
It's beautiful that you just brought that up, because whatever BTS went through as a group of seven, they practice that. They practice empathy, and they practice that in heavy dosage, because I think that's the biggest appeal of these seven, you know, young men, is that they are so actualized in that way. They kind of understand that however they came up in their industry sector, they weren't people who were the chosen a band. They were, you know, the outcast. The it sounds like they were not, you know, in prime position to become who they are. And I think because of that, that empathy, that resounding empathy that they have today is very apparent. So it's very interesting that you bring that up. It's everything. It's key to sort of our kindness and our existence as human beings.
No, absolutely. It's their value system.
Yeah.
Right. And that value system was established early on when they were just, seeds, when they were just beginning this. And I really do respect them because they've continued to scale those values. And to this effect, because, you know, that is so important that they're still scaling those values because they have global impact now. So I definitely see them fully as an aspirational model. They're really great what they're doing.
Absolutely. Now, Vervet, that's how we pronounce it, right?
Yeah, you know, it's we're not going to correct you though. You know, I mean, some people say Vervet and that's fine too, you know. And whatever, you know, language accent that you might have, it's, you know, there's fine. There's not one way to say it, you know. But yeah, that's Vervet. It's named after Vervet monkeys. They love booze. They love cocktails. And when you're not looking, they'll steal your drink. So they're really cute and playful. That's what inspired the name.
Where did you find that fun fact?
YouTube. So it was, yeah.
Do you think a lot of different monkeys given a choice would pick some boozy drink to throw down?
I don't know. We looked for other monkeys and I'm sure it does happen, but it was definitely prevalent in Vervet monkeys, so much so a study was funded, you know, of their alcohol consumption behaviors because it mirrored human data so closely.
Wow.
But, you know, at the time, you know, I was to inspire the name, I was looking for other animals because I knew animals, like, you know, the history of it is that as humans we were watching animals like eat very ripe fruit that would eventually ferment, the sugar would turn to alcohol and they would act silly. So there's bears that do that, there's birds, you know, that do that as well, the waxwing bird. But in this case, Vervet really sort of seemed to make the most sense for us.
So you put this company together, but what led to this?
You know, I think so much of it was becoming an entrepreneur is a few things. Let's first of all, you know, right away is like all entrepreneurs have a financial goal, right? So that's something I think we all have in common. So yes, that's just, you just have to accept that, but it's more than that. You know, I do agree when I began my entrepreneurial journey, the first advice, you know, what you hear all the time is if you're just doing this for money, it's likely it's going to fail. And I could not agree more. So, you know, because there's plenty of things I could have done for money. I could have started up, you know, many other different types of companies and products and services that was just financially driven. I wasn't interested only in that. So, you know, I think entrepreneurs at some point you get tired of ranting, just having such, you know, you're just so upset about what you're seeing happening, in the marketplace and in the culture. And you just, that's it. And that's what motivates you. I'm going to do it myself, you know? And that's exactly what happened, you know, on the financial side. I want to not only take care of myself, but I want to take care of my mom. Like if people who know me know what I want to do, I want to obviously get her a place in Vietnam, you know, so she can stay there as long as she likes throughout the year. She still has family there, you know? But yeah, that rant became the spark of an idea. At the idea stage, you turn your rant and you begin plotting and planning of what you would do. What is your solution? And I think in 2016, you know, living here in Los Angeles, like on the brand side, I was just seeing what was happening. Like this is an LA brand and it was so exclusive, you know, it was largely, you know, white hipsters for white hipsters. And LA, you know, is an incredibly diverse place. And how could you just invisibilize everyone else? And then also take ideas from all these other cultures and not include them in a meaningful way. And I don't mean as models on your Instagram page. You know, I could really, I don't really give a shit about that. You know, I mean meaningful, you know, in the company, you know, elevated positions, you know, some equity ownership integrated into the brand, you know. So that's was a big driving force, you know, of wanting to become an entrepreneur.
We're seeing in the last few years, 2-3 years, a proliferation of Asian-owned beverage companies. Yourself, and there's Songkai Gin, there's Su Ti Distillery, there's the Wind Coffee brand. There's so many, but you could have picked something else. I mean, because you're producing, you're a photographer, you could have picked another sort of niche to get into, to produce and to make waves in terms of culturally. But why specifically drinks?
Why booze? Okay.
Why booze? That's, yeah.
Well, I think we love craft cocktails. There's three founders and we all share that interest deeply, you know, over beer, over wine, of all this sort of like, you know, alcoholic beverages out there. Craft cocktails are just, there's a level of storytelling and craft and so many different components that goes in, and you get to blend this together and have different experiences, textures and colors, mouthfeel, but it's the storytelling and the connection to agriculture, how it's connected. So that, you know, because of that interest in what we knew the best, that was, you know, we wanted it to be specifically cocktails in this case. And also for the added effect that because of the way the brand was coming together, which is about celebrating many cultures and, you know, this inclusivity, like what brings drinks are designed for exactly that, to bring people together. So I couldn't imagine a better vehicle to celebrate the brand vision than good ass drinks, you know, to bring people together. And that really, you know, became sort of a powerful defining glue that really brought it all together.
I've read a few articles on what you've done and your co-founders, and I think a resounding sort of ethos is the no shortcuts path to formula, to figuring out what you're putting into this stuff. I think that's, for me, the biggest differentiator that I've felt as I'm looking into the work that you're doing. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you hear the word disruption a lot when you become an entrepreneur. And I think one of the ways to achieve a successful disruption is, you know, avoid the status quo, which avoiding the status quo means you're also not taking shortcuts, because by doing the practicing the status quo, yeah, that's a shortcut. That's a shortcut to the market, right? Because the solutions are already there. However, the downside of that is you're going to have a product identical to the status quo. So that's not a disruption. And then you put too much, in my opinion, if you do that, you put too much pressure on the brand side to be disruptive. And then, you know, you have to lean into this marketing story and create this fictional universe to differentiate your product from a brand point of view, but the product itself is misaligned, right? So your brand will be disruptive, but your product is status quo. And that's something that we wanted to avoid. And at the same time, what we wanted to really do is, how do we bring what we love about craft cocktails out from behind the bar and into this format? That was a puzzle. That was very, very difficult journey. And I think if you talk to my co-founders, yeah, I think we still question, you know, the wisdom of that. It was really hard.
What was hard about it?
Well, So many craft cocktails, especially, you know, use fresh juice, you know, so the, and how do we bring that incredible flavor experience to this, to the can format without using lab made flavors, right? Because that's what you would normally do. Fresh raw juice spoils very, very quickly. It's not stable. Obviously, when you're at a craft cocktail bar, you get to consume that product, you know, right away. There's
right.
Shelf life is not an issue, but in this format, it is. So that was, once we came up with the solution in craft cocktails, there's something called, you know, clarified cocktails. Clarification is a really cool process that many bar programs do. You just essentially, you remove a lot of the solid material, which has no flavor value. It's just solid material. And then you're just left with this beautiful clarified liquid. You get all the flavor. But in doing so, you're increasing the stability. So once we had that solution in place, it's the labor intensiveness of it all, of filtering that volume of liquid, you know, once we started scaling up. So it was very hard. And that also for bitters, vermouth and Amaro, bartenders are accustomed, you know, you're reaching for an end product. It's already bottled, you measure it out, you know. For us, that wasn't the case. So we had to make our own. And that was a learning process and lots of R&D, learning how to infuse for this and how to, you know, it's like infusion is basically step proofing. So you can begin with very high proof alcohol, 180, 190 proof. And some you infuse at 120 or 100 proof, and just learning the steps and when to do so.
Now, when you, I think I've asked this in many moons ago to somebody else, but I'm still not clear when people say infuse. Like, I just think of just putting two things together, and there you go. You got a fusion of two different liquids or whatever. What does that really mean?
You're basically, you just, it's as simple as that. You combine two elements together. One behaves as the extractor. One element behaves as the extractor, and the other one is providing the value. So when we infuse, the extractor component is the alcohol. So we have 190 proof spirit. And when we introduce Saigon cinnamon, the Saigon cinnamon gives, and the alcohol is pulling, you know, just of the characteristics of the material. So it's pulling that flavor out. But 190 proof has a lot of extraction power. So dry material and roots and barks are really good at that level of proof. It's like super high heat, like a wok burner. And then, you know, we just learned as you step down and you dilute it with RO water, reverse osmosis water, that 120 proof or 100 proof, you would introduce more delicate items and delicate botanicals.
So interesting. You know, Ron, really quickly touch on that whole idea of Saigon cinnamon. I love to cook. I think you're a big, you love to cook as well. And when I've gone to look for baking material, I've seen different types of cinnamon, and I've always seen Saigon cinnamon. And what is that like a real thing? Like, why would they brand cinnamon as Saigon cinnamon? What's the root behind that?
Yeah, from what I understand, it's native to our country, and it grows there. And within that that genus, there's many different types, right? Cassias and cinnamons grows from India to Vietnam, you know, it grows, and they're all kind of have different qualities. It's like the basil family. It's for me, as a part of my definition of what being a Vietnamese American is, what I wanted to do is make sure that I'm adding aspirational value, and we wanted to celebrate it. We just don't say cinnamon, or I use cinnamon from maybe an outsider's definition of what is a superior cinnamon. You know, I'm just coming out there. No, it's Saigon cinnamon. It's bomb as fuck. You know, it's like, it's super tasty. And we use that in our recipe. And it's one of the feature flavors of our Amaro that we make. It's Saigon cinnamon and orange peels and grapefruit peels, you know, and other things that are, you know, local to Southern California. But yeah, so that's the inspiration, is, you know, it natively grows in Vietnam.
Now, this idea of removing the solids, that means that there is it a heated process, or is it just sort of a filtering? Like, what's the process of removing the solids to just leave back the liquid form?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of ways to clarify. You know, at a very small scale, 10 ounces, 12 ounce behind a bar, there's a mini centrifuge you can use. You can use gravity filtration, you know, through various filtering media. You can also use agents like gelatins that will grab the solid material and pull it down, and then you would draw off the top. There's also a freezing method. For us, for our current batch, we use something called a plate filter. It's got 40 plates. It works with very high air pressure, and the raw material, the raw juice, goes through all these 40 plates. And by the end, it reaches its this nearly clear, beautiful liquid. But eventually, we hope to, there's commercial size centrifuges, which makes the process a lot easier. And it's more sustainable too. You don't have to use all this filter media. And then our process right now, you can also have a lot of waste. But yeah, that's clarification on a large scale.
It almost reminds me of clarified butter, right?
Same thing. You remove the butter solids, right? And you're left with this clarified butter without a lot of solids. And that means you can cook at it at higher temperature because the solid materials won't burn.
When you say that the flavor is more stabilized, are you saying that all of that solids that you remove really affect the shelf life of whatever fruit juices that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I I'm not the person to talk to about the exact science of why that oxidation happens if you don't filter, but it does. That's why a lot of bar programs, a lot of times they'll clarify their juice. Because you go through so much work, like juicing fruit, like, is a lot of work. And to make sure that you get the most out of that effort, you can clarify it, and your fresh juice will last longer for your drinks.
Yeah, this is a truly no shortcuts path.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we just released our sake tonic too, and we ended up making our own tonic syrup. You know, our recipe developer Hope just started R&Ding. And it's a very clever recipe, and a lot of work went into it, you know, before we can start scaling it. But, you know, we really, you know, hold in high regard all the work of the craft cocktail movement. And we really want to bring that out authentically as much as we can. We really want to pay our respects. And at the same time, you know, we're practicing hospitality, you know, which means, you know, we care about that customer and make sure they're happy, and we're giving them the best drink that we possibly can, you know, and we want to give them that value and that experience. And that's what really drives us, you know, is the customer, and, you know, making sure they're having a completely novel and new experience. And we really want to capture and delight their imagination, you know, so that's what our driving force.
There's a lot of intentionality in the things that you do, whether it's, you know, the clarification process, the sugar that you use, this idea of labeling, the idea of using, you know, metal cans versus plastic. That must all drive up the cost a lot, right?
It does. It really, really does. You know, all of our decision-making process is how we determine our spend is based off of our three values, right? Like diversity, equity, inclusion, sustainability, and, you know, practicing the art of of craft cocktails, you know. Part of that sustainability, we feel, is being transparent. And that really goes towards our labeling and showing our ingredients on there. You know, for example, one thing we're really proud of is, like, and we're transparent with, is the fact of the matter is to be completely shelf stable, we have to use a preservative, but we ended up investing in a plant-based preservative. I believe we might be the first company to do so, a beverage alcohol company, and not chemical stabilization, right? So the packaging itself, we chose aluminum cans just because of its recyclability percentage. You know, aluminum cans, like one can, over 98% of one aluminum can be recycled into the next aluminum can. There's not much material loss. And it's also lightweight, you know, it's opaque, no light comes in. So it's a really great packaging format. And at the same time, we also invested in aluminum cans that do not have BPA in the liner. And there's only, at the time when we bought this, you know, our inventory, like, I think just one company was doing it, Ball, and I think there's more now. But yeah, that drives up the cost when you seek that type of packaging out with those features. And there was, like, aluminum can supply too. So there was like issues with that around the global supply chain.
I had no idea there was BPAs and aluminum can products.
Yeah, there's a very, very thin, clear liner on the inside of all aluminum cans. And in learning that, you know, we just practice our value. Okay, well, let's avoid the liners with BPA. So that was the liner choice.
What's the liner used for?
It helps. It's definitely for all the various businesses. Like, people package all different types of liquids into aluminum cans. They have various pHs, and they also, there's trace, like, metal elements in many different types of organic material that could have a negative reaction with a raw bare aluminum and cause corrosion, and then the can will leak. So it's designed to prevent leakage.
Wow. Yeah, that's a lot of detail. So when we talk about, like, going back to the whole pricing thing, is Vervette priced higher? And if it is, like, how do you mitigate the sort of the consumer's decision to go with something cheaper? Or is it something that is baked into this idea of a premium product, and people are just going to read it and go, okay, we'll rather buy at a higher price point and go with the better quality? I mean, is that a consideration in the way that you put the product out price-wise?
Absolutely. And man, that is a conversation we talk about constantly. Right now we're $22 a four pack, you know, typically, and, you know, it's $5.50 for a drink, $6, but we feel this level of this quality of drink, we're bringing so much value to this product. And I think in exchange for $5.50 or $6 is the consumer is getting a lot of value. You know, I mean, this same drink, if you just made this at a bar, it would take you 2 weeks, you know, and most craft cocktail bars would charge, you know, $18 for it. I think for us, like, we're going to do our best job of being transparent and educating the consumer on everything that we're doing. And it's going to be up to them if they're getting the value or not. I mean, it's, this whole game is a game of assumptions. And, you know, we are assuming that, like, for a premium cocktail, at $6 a can, at $5.50 a can, is pretty fair. I mean, I think given the rise of cost, just raw materials, you know, we may be forced to increase the price a bit more. But, you know, part of the mission of the brand too is, you know, we're not just going for the 1%, right? Like, you know, because of my experience growing up, and I know what it's like growing up poor and still wanting to have really great products and, you know, great stuff in my life. But, you know, we don't want to be too expensive where we exclude, you know, large swaths of people like that. So we try to be mindful of that pricing, you know, and making sure that it can work in most people's budget. But we do know we're expensive.
Look, I'm going to, I don't want to be crucified for what I'm about to say, but you know, I can speak from my own cultural relative perspective, which is, as a Vietnamese person, I'm kind of trained or kind of forced into the path of buying things that are not, that are typically not at a higher price point, and quality be damned, right? Like if I ever saw a $30 bowl of pho, that would prevent me from going into that restaurant, you know? And this is what we're dealing with. We're dealing with, you know, and I talk about this constantly. If you're cooking a bowl of pho and you're putting like $1 or $2 per pound of bone per bowl, you're looking at a, you know, easily a $15 bowl of pho, and the gas that's, you know, and the time that's it's on the stove and it's cooking in a big pot, it drives the costs up, but you get all the gelatin and you get all of the goodies that we cook at home, and the quality is different. So Vervet is doing the same thing. It's, you're providing basically a dollar bowl of pho, but culturally we have not moved. Look, I don't want to get crucified for this, but for the most part, the world has not moved beyond that for Vietnamese products. And we need to, we need to have the Vervet way of thinking when we're approaching Vietnamese foods. I mean, the whole world needs to see it that way. So that's sort of my two cents always on this direction.
You're absolutely right. You know, when, you know, obviously the Vietnamese population, we came here, most of us, if after the war especially, we were so impoverished. And the decision-making process was based on one value, cost. That's it, you know? Now, what that does, and specifically what we're talking about here is food, a bowl of pho, what is going to happen? You're going to, if as a consumer, you know, you're like, you know, it's like, no, a bowl of pho should never be $30, let alone 15, right? You know, what happens is, for the business owner and operator, they have to make a living too. So what happened, they're going to have to take shortcuts. So they're not going to, you're not going to get that, you're going to get a bowl of pho, but it's going to have decisions in there that were based on economics, right? I mean, are they using bouillon? Where are they taking their shortcuts? So it's like, you know,
it's always cubes, powdered cubes. Yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, eventually it's up to us, you know, as consumers, we vote with our dollars and what we want to support. But I do think, which with each ensuing generation, you know, we're gonna move that needle, and we're gonna move that line of scrimmage, you know, to a different place. You know, I see, you know, you look at the early Italian immigrants and the cost of their food, and when that started escalating to reflect the real value of labor and quality ingredients, we saw the price go up, and larger culture really accepted it, you know, and embraced it. You know, right now here in LA, you know, you could buy these pasta products, you know, these from great chefs, you know, $30-$40 a plate, you know, but Xiaolongbao or Ban Gong, you know, which is so labor intensive, you know, it's, you know, our own community, and obviously that means the outside community doesn't expect it, won't embrace it or support it, but that's changing. And it's based off of entrepreneurial spirit and creators coming into the space and leading the way.
That's why if you're in a big city and you eat an $8 bowl of pho, you're in dangerous red alert territory, because $8 is buying you bullion. It's buying you powdered taste, and you're buying decisions that are not good for your body at an $8 bowl. The minimum, I think, it should be a $15 bowl of pho if they're doing it, you know, right. And even still, in this market, in this day and age, $15 bowl of pho, you really can't get quality, I feel, because the cost of gas, the cost of rent, the cost of labor, the cost of bones, all of these things to produce this, like, Vervet level product is it's missing. It's not going to happen.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, just taking into the hard facts of that economic model you just presented, absolutely, $15 is where it should be. That's the cost of a bowl of ramen. And ramen is
$18.20 for a bowl of ramen.
Yeah, it's very labor intensive, multiple days. If you're really practicing it in the way that it could be, where it would provide the best experience, it's, you can't get around the time investment, you know, that it takes and all the number of ingredients and just the human effort of watching it and, you know, and as it goes along. And then there's all the other components too, as well, that go into it. But no, you're absolutely right.
You know, we need to have this like massive pho pot made of glass. And then you have like a display where you can put two or three of these pots on and just dump like 20, 30 pounds of bone so people can see the actual bone on the fire cooking. And then you can charge $30 for, because you know, that's really where the money's at, is that gelatinous extract that's happening while you're having this 8 to 12 hour, you know, boil.
No, that's right. And that's how you can tell really good pho broth. You can, you know, pucker your lips and you should feel a little bit of a gelatin, that kind of a little bit of stickiness. No, you're absolutely right. Or the other thing is you just have smaller portions, you know, if you're going to want to charge an $8-$10 bowl, you can just reduce the size, you know. But yeah, it's very, very challenging, I think, for next gen to who have such interest in our food culture. And balancing that price point. And because like most people, they don't want to exclude anyone, you know, especially the older generation. And we don't want to repel them, you know, but our community, you know, our income earning, you know, that's a larger conversation, right? For historically excluded groups, we don't have that generational wealth yet. We don't have that quite privileges. Some of us do. But once, you know, we start getting that critical mass and historically excluded groups can increase their income and wealth, and we could really support creators like this.
I'm going to transition over to Korean and Vietnamese culture from food. So when you look at, because you are of mixed heritage, when you look at the Korean flag and the Vietnamese flag, and I don't mean any North or South Vietnamese flag, but just the flag in general, you know, a flag that represents whichever side you're from, and the Korean flag. What kind of emotions are going through your mind?
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Okay. There's so much. And it's something I truly think about every day. I really, truly do. The two countries have such similar histories when it comes to the last century. But the outcome of the main struggle is completely different. You know, in Korea, we got to see the democratic capitalist side and ideology win through a struggle of war, right? And that was fought out over that. In Vietnam, it went the other way, where the ideology led by China, you know, I guess, communist ideology is what prevailed. So the outcomes couldn't have been different, even though they started similarly, you know, in these civil wars. But what that means is, for me, I think about our two flags. You know, we know the flag of South Vietnam, yellow background, three red stripes. And the other flag, the current flag of the country of Vietnam, accepted by the global community, red background, yellow star. Yeah, I wouldn't say that either of those flags represent me. And so I don't rep them, you know. In fact, I think it in my pitch deck, you know, like it, when it's like the meet the team slide, you know, it has my flags. It has the Korean flag. And the other flag for Vietnam, it just says made in Vietnam. So it's because, you know, I think the values of that, the flag right now of the government that's in power, you know, the values of that don't fully represent me. So for me as personally, and it's different, I think, for all Vietnamese Americans, and also all Vietnamese in the diaspora.
Certainly,
very different. It's different for everyone. But you know, they don't represent my values, so I can't really return it. I can't represent that. The yellow background with the three red stripes, you know, that flag was our flag growing up, right? And but it's evolved and changed over the years. You know, I think seeing that flag pop up in some of our different political groups, you know, that don't represent my values, but it showed up so powerfully and so strongly, you know, particularly at the insurrection, that was hard for me personally. So, and what that sort of flag stands for now, but you know, that can change. I feel like that flag can change, you know? So again, that's a work in progress, but right now I'm not representing that flag, but that can change.
But the Korean flag for you, there's a certain, you know, when I think about flags, sometimes the symbolic list of bullets, and I don't mean like gun bullets, but I mean like a bullet point, you know, there's KPIs that when you look at a certain flag, you're just like, automatically, intuitively, you have these KPIs like, oh, that checks off, that checks off, that checks off. You know, there has to be some sort of bullet point checklist that evokes a certain approval that happens for you with the flags that you see, because it's not black or white, but I'm sure that there is some sort of association with some indicators that indexes that you feel on an intuitive level. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the United Nations uses something, the Human Development Index, you know, it's based on some factors of kind of how they rank and sort countries, you know. Korea ranks pretty high on that, and Vietnam doesn't. And, you know, their list, you know, I think that kind of includes, you know, everything from life expectancy, education, earning power of each individual. And they kind of collate all that information together. And, you know, I think that's just one little group of KPIs. And, you know, I think that's, I care about our country so much, and I care about its success. I'm invested, and I'm always going to celebrate the culture, you know, but I want to see that applied to our people. And there's right now, there's just such a lack of evidence there. I mean, listen, I think both of us have traveled to Vietnam. You'd see it with your own eyes, you know? And I've been to Korea, and it's very different, you know? And I think Korea can be an inspiration to Vietnam, because in three generations, they've achieved the level of success, financial success, and cultural success in three generations. That's very, very impressive in a very short amount of time. And it was a very intentional plan. It was very, you know, they had a great plan and a roadmap, you know, to victory. And, you know, I of course, seeing the Vietnam is what, it's very different. It couldn't, the two countries could not be different. You know, Korea went from one of the top below, you know, bottom 10 in poorest countries to where it is now. But I follow, you know, news coming out of Vietnam, and there's like a lot of amazing efforts going on. So while it may not happen in three generations, I mean, it will happen at its own pace, but I hopefully it will continue to do so. And that structures are in place within that country where that wealth, cultural wealth and financial wealth, is distributed in an equitable way.
Yeah.
That's meaningful, that really brings the floor up.
If we are struggling to do that here in the United States, I mean, you know, I think all around the world, it's a problem. It's a universal problem.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Absolutely. It definitely is. So yeah, we're struggling with it here. So that's why whatever, you know, happens there, I fully understand the challenges.
Speaking of challenges, what is the critical marker for you with Vervette in terms of distribution? Like, are you past that magical sort of, you know, success point where you're like, okay, the brand's good on its own, you don't have to worry much, or you're just starting out and you have these milestones? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, we have not crossed that threshold. I don't know when we will, but we're going to. The team is really great. My co-founders are really wonderful, and we, you know, continually, I think month on month, people learn about us and we get more supporters. You know, making sure that, you know, just Americans, and, you know, we're going to start here in Los Angeles in the city, which is huge, to make sure that we're available and people know about us. So one of those things is making sure that we have really great retail partners, you know, like Whole Foods or Erewhon or Gelson's, and just, you know, making sure that we're out there, because we can't do it on our own. So it's allyship, partnership, right? So that's really what it is. We really need these key partnerships, and we're working towards that, and I think we're getting close. And I think that's really going to help get our brand out there, and what we're doing, our brand values and our product values. And we're doing our own effort. We're lucky enough to have our own online store now. Finally, it is a little complicated to do, but people can experience the brand and the products that way, and we try to make it as affordable as possible.
You can ship alcohol online now?
Yeah, to 41 states. We have an e-com partner that we need to do, because we're a heavily regulated industry. So they are the compliance partner. As a beverage alcohol, we just can't set up our own Shopify and start shipping.
Right, right.
So we have this e-commerce partner that manages the compliancy.
What's the hardest part of this journey?
Scaling is, everything is painful. I think growing our distribution partners is very, very hard. You just have to have a lot of patience, because the larger the retail partner and the impact they can have on growing your company, they have a big process. There's a lot of people involved, and you just have to be willing to be patient. So that's a very challenging thing, is being patient. Most entrepreneurs, we are not, you know.
Yeah, you're right.
We want to get it done now.
Yesterday, you know? Yeah.
That's exactly right. So that's probably the hardest thing to do is being patient. And that's hard. But, you know, there's always costing issues, typical pain points, rising costs and lead times. Our production is challenging just because of the multiple steps involved and the time and labor and quality control. But, you know, we're getting better at it. Like, each time we do it, we are able to economize our operations and be able to streamline that process more.
Thank you so much for really opening up all of the details of your life and the way you see the world and the product that you're bringing out into the world. I hope that you and I both have the grit to get back on in the next 5 years and constantly touch base and talk about cultural issues and this radical okayness and where we're going with Asian American sort of existing in the bigger picture. And thank you so much again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It was wonderful having this conversation with you. Thank you.
Great. Talk to you soon.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran and Javier Proenza. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit Hyland.com.